From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is enjoying one last day of vacation, and I'm enjoying one last day here in balmy Philadelphia before I return to foggy San Francisco. Today's show is a treat, featuring a live concert with singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright III. We'll get a sample of his particular brand of sardonic, satiric songmaking. And I'll talk with writer Martin Cruz Smith. In 1981, he had a huge bestseller with his suspense novel, Gorky Park. Today, he describes the research aboard a Soviet ship for his new sequel called Polar Star. Critic Milo Miles introduces us to the world of world music, and film critic Owen Gleiberman takes a second look at the comedy spoof, The Naked Gun. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater announced today a $65 million aid package to Cambodia, or rather to Colombia, to help fight drug trafficking. Tom Verdi of Maine Public Broadcasting has this report.
The package will include equipment for police and military personnel, with initial shipments to arrive as early as next week.
Fitzwater said that U.S. advisors would be a part of the package, but emphasized that they would be on hand in Colombia for training purposes only. The package was drafted in the last few days and is in reaction to recent violence in Colombia's drug war. The package includes 8 Huey helicopters used to transport troops and equipment, plus small arms. The $65 million cleans out a fund made available to the White House through the Foreign Assistance Act. The first shipment should be off within 2 weeks, and includes machine guns, mortars and ammunition, ambulances, communication equipment, and anti-tank guns. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Verdi with the President in Kennebunkport.
Venezuelan police say they've arrested 7 people and seized 141 pounds of cocaine from a state-owned ship docked in the northern port of Puerto Cabello. It is reportedly one of the largest drug seizures in Venezuela this year. The ship used to transport aluminum and iron ore was bound for Frankfurt and Amsterdam. In New York, 4 white youths were charged today with assault and riot for their alleged role in a racial attack in which a black teenager was shot to death. Police say they are still searching for the gunman. Police received death threats against the suspects who wore bulletproof vests when they were taken to be booked. Police say 16-year-old Yusef Hawkins was shot to death Wednesday night on a Brooklyn street in an attack by a gang of white men seeking revenge for a friend whose girlfriend left him to date blacks and Hispanics. Secretary of State James Baker has decided not to attend the close of a peace conference in Paris on the situation in Cambodia. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
A month ago, Baker attended the opening round of the conference on Cambodia, but will not return for the closing ministerial-level meeting set to start on Monday. The State Department said Baker is unhappy with what he regards as the inflexible attitude of Vietnam and its allied government in Cambodia. At issue is the composition of a transitional government that would take power once the Vietnamese troop withdrawal from Cambodia is completed. The United States wants former Cambodian head of state Prince Norodom Sihanouk to head the interim government. But Cambodia rejects any participation by one of Sihanouk's coalition partners, the Khmer Rouge, the same group believed to have killed more than 1 million Cambodians during its 3.5-year rule in the 1970s. Sihanouk believes the Khmer Rouge would be more dangerous out of government than inside. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2 points to close at 2732.36. This is NPR News. Voyager 2 flew by Neptune's North Pole today and photographed volcanoes on the moon Triton. Voyager capped its historic 12-year tour of 4 planets when it skimmed 3,000 miles over Neptune's pole, then dove past Triton. Voyager's closest photos of Triton were recorded on tape for playback to Earth this weekend. Those returned today astonished NASA scientists. Researchers are concluding an expedition in Lake Superior this week that has yielded some dramatic photographs of the sunken freighter Edmund Fitzgerald, which went down 14 years ago. Sally Isley of member station WKAR reports.
The photographs were taken by a submerged robot using a special 3-dimensional video camera. They show vivid images of the wreck, its hull and pilot house squashed, lying in 2 pieces on the bottom of Lake Superior. The Edmund Fitzgerald sank with no distress call. All 29 crew members perished. Some speculate the ship hit a shoal and broke in two. Others guess that 30-foot sea swamped the massive vessel. Researchers say the videotape has brought them no closer to solving that mystery, but the main goal of this expedition was more to test the camera equipment for use in other shipwreck research. For National Public Radio, I'm Sally Isley reporting.
The Federal Election Commission reported today the 16 candidates who received primary matching funds in the last presidential campaign spent more than triple the amount spent in the 1976 primary. In its final statistical report on the pre-nomination period of the 1988 campaign, the FEC said that 8 Democrats, 6 Republicans, and 2 outside candidates spent $211 million and took in $214 million. A French parliamentary delegation abruptly canceled an official visit to Chad today, citing what it called sudden deterioration in relations between the countries. The cancellation came 48 hours after Chad publicly criticized France's army. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Sedge Thompson. Terry Gross is still rusticating. If you were to believe his songs, you'd probably think my guest today is a pretty messed up guy. Well, Loudon Wainwright III writes darkly humorous songs about relationships and the absurdities of life. 17 years ago, he had a hit with a song he wrote in 15 minutes called Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road. On his new album, Therapy, he takes on music videos, celebrity, parenthood, and he uses flypaper as a metaphor for a relationship. Wainwright is also an actor. He's appeared in the TV series MASH as Captain Calvin Spaulding, and more recently he acted in the films The Slugger's Wife and Jackknife. Loudon Wainwright is here with us today with his guitar and some songs that some of them will be new to us. Welcome. Thanks for coming by Fresh Air today.
It's nice to be here.
Your album is currently named Therapy, but you'd wanted to call it Propensities?
Right. We were afraid, but the record company told me that no one would know, the rack jobbers wouldn't know how to spell it in the stores. Or wouldn't know what it meant. But I did want to call it Propensities.
Why Propensities? And
well, I just I thought Propensities was a cooler title, you know. But Therapy is the title now, and I've grown to learn to love and live with that, and there's a song on the album called Therapy, and I'll play it for you now. I wonder why you love me, baby. I hardly love myself at all. I think we're both a little crazy. We need some therapy, that's all. I'll see a man, you see a woman. You need a mom, I need a dad. It's not our fault we have this problem. Our parents made us, we were. And I know that there's someone out there who knows what the hell is happening. You know that we must do something, 'cause God knows and he's not helping. Just twice a week for just an hour. Just walk on in, just let it out. I know we'll both feel so much better. Don't let depression win the bout. Up those awful feelings.
not the one who knows it all. There is a nice big box of Kleenex if you break down and start to bawl. And I know that there's someone out there who knows what the hell is happening. You know that we must do something, 'cause God knows and he's not helping. I'm full of fear and paranoia. You are hysterical and sad. Let's do it, babe, you know I love you. It costs so much, it can't be bad. I wonder why you love me, baby. I hardly love myself at all. I think we're both a little crazy. We need some therapy, that's all. Just $80 an hour, that's all.
I always thought that therapists should give money-back guarantees.
Good idea.
Yeah. Costs so much, it can't be bad. My guest today is songwriter Loudon Wainwright III. He's in town to perform at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. His new album, Therapy, is on Silvertone Records. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest in the studio today is Loudon Wainwright III. How much has your name affected your sense of yourself? I ask because my name is Sedgefield Thompson
III. You've got a
weird
name, too.
Right.
I didn't know you were the third.
Yes. And and somehow I think that I might have been a different person if I were named Jake or Jesse or something. I wonder how you've reflected on that.
Well, of course, I hated my name as a kid because it's Loudon is such a weird name. And, of course... Then I went to drama school and my speech teacher said, Loudon, it's such a beautiful name. What a pity you can't pronounce it. and then I grew to love it soon after that, after I left drama school. And, the third is a bit of an embarrassment, but my father, was quite a famous journalist for Life magazine and he got the name Loudon Wainwright. So to avoid the confusion, I used the third to, you know.
But he also used the second as part of his byline, didn't he?
No, although technically he was the second or junior. But we used to argue about that all the time, actually. Who is, you know, we had quite a competitive relationship. But it is my real name. And it's misspelled a lot, unfortunately. And I have a song about that. You mentioned the Philadelphia Folk Festival. You know, I've played the Philadelphia Folk Festival many times over the last 20 years, and they still managed to misspell it in the program, which is heartwarming and reassuring because some things never change. And some things they never get right. But here's a song that I wrote a couple of weeks ago, actually.
They spelled my name wrong again, with an E between the D and the N. Some dope didn't know it should be an O. They spelled my name wrong again. Why in God's name can't they check? It's a pain in the ass and the neck. Not a capital crime, but it's the umpteenth time. Why in God's name can't they check? I see my name up there in lights. Then I notice it's not spelled right. Tell me why do I put up with it? Pavarotti most surely would quit. When you been around for a while, these spelling mistakes start to rile. I guess that's rock and roll. Dyslexia takes its toll. You've been around for a while. My parents should shoulder some blame. Calling their kid a strange name. Spell it with me, friend. L-O-U-D-O-N. My parents should shoulder some blame. My eyes narrow. I start to squint. I think that's my name there. Tell me why do I put up with it? Sinatra would have a shit fit. Wainwright has two W's. They get that one wrong and I get the blues. That old grammar school tries, just not good enough, guys. Wainwright has two W's. One day I thought I would die when I saw with my very own eye L-U-D-I-N. W-E-I-M-R-I-G-H-T. Thought I would die.
You look in anguish as if even the recollection that your name has been misspelled is causing you pain. Jura, parents of that song, how'd they react?
I don't think my father died this year, actually, so he didn't get to hear it. And my mother hasn't heard it because it's a new song. It's not out on anything. So I'm sure she'll love it. She loves everything I do.
I always think that we're all damaged goods in one way or another. We all expect the world to treat us the way our mothers did. And if our mothers treated us as, that the world would be a nice place, that's how we expect the world to treat us. And if our mothers treated us harshly, we expect the world to treat us harshly.
I just read this article in the New York Times in the science section or something like that about cats and how psychologically they think that all human beings are their mother to take care of them. So that's why they're so confident and relaxed and can fall 15 stories on their feet.
Boy, if they got a surprise.
Dogs think other people are... Dogs think that human beings are other dogs, But Katz thinks that all human beings are their mother. I think that's why they're so sane.
You once said about your father, the journalist Loudon Wainwright II, who worked for Life magazine, "I watched my father be tortured and make deadlines and stare at blank pieces of paper. It never seemed like much fun to me." Songwriting, though, I'd think is sometimes looking at blank pieces of paper.
Well, sometimes it is, although I don't do it that way. I mean, I don't claim to not be tortured about what I do, too, but... the way that I do it is I get an idea about something that I want to write about, and then I just kind of carry it around, and then there's a time when I'll start to write it down or pick up the guitar and start to, you know, make some kind of a little tune for it. I know that there are some songwriters that get up in the morning and sharpen pencils and sit down in front of that blank piece of paper and write songs. I don't do it that way. And that could be a reaction to watching my father have to make deadlines all his life. And the other thing is, of course, I don't have deadlines. I can write at my own luxury, or in my own time, really. Although if a certain amount of time goes by and nothing comes out, I start to create my own pressure and worry about it and torture myself about it.
Part of writing about what you know as you're getting older yourself is dealing with aging parents.
Mm.
How have you dealt with this in your songs?
Well, I've been in the last couple of years, I've written a lot about, I've certainly written about myself aging, or at least referred to the fact that I'm getting older, and children. And on this, on Therapy, there's a song called Thanksgiving, which is about, which is about the whole family situation. And I mentioned about aging parents. My father, as I've mentioned in this interview, died this year. And I wondered for a while if I was going to write a song about that. I mean, it's such a momentous event that one immediately thinks that, well, one would have to, really. And I did, actually. But the type of song that I wrote about it, the tone of it, actually surprised me. And here it is. Sometimes I forget that you've gone. You've gone and you're not coming back. And it's hard to believe that you're still not here. What's left behind refutes that fact. Your closet's still full of your clothes and your shoes, and your bookcase still holds all your books. It's as if all you'd done was to go out of town. You'll be back soon, that's just how it looks. But your suitcase is empty, it's right here in the hall. And that's not even the strangest thing. Why would you leave your wallet behind? Your glasses, your wristwatch and ring. Your glasses, your wristwatch and ring. Sometimes I forget that you've gone, and that we'll never see you again. For a moment, I gotta give him a call. But I can't now, I realize then. No, we can't meet for lunch at the usual place.
something I knew that you'd wanna know. I could go by myself to our old haunt, but that seems such a strange thing to do. The waiters would wonder what was going on. Why weren't you there? Where were you? Why weren't you there? Where were you? Sometimes I forget that you have gone. I remember and I feel the ache. How could it have happened? How could it be? It's not true, there must be some mistake. Mementos and memories, tell me what good are they? Not and not much to have and to hold. And it's true that you've gone and you're not coming back. And this world seems so empty and cold. Oh, but sometimes something happens and it doesn't seem strange. You're not far away, you're near. Sometimes I forget that you have gone. Sometimes it feels like you're right here. Right now it feels like you're right here.
You know, I've always thought the pity of songs that are memories of people who've died is that they never get to hear them.
Mm, yeah. Well, if he is still here, maybe he's hearing it. I mean, it's spooky, but sometimes you do get that feeling that they're still here. And I hope you like it, Dad, if you heard it. Maybe he's in San Francisco and he's hearing it on the radio out there or something like that.
Thank you very much, Loudon Wainwright III.
Thank you.
Loudon Wainwright III is appearing at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. His new record, Therapy, is on the Silvertone label. I'm Sedgefield Thompson III, and this is Fresh Air. Loudon, could you play us out?
Summer's almost over. Soon it's back to school. Soon they drain the water out of the swimming pool. Adopt a brand new attitude, a positive outlook. Buy yourself some pencils and a loose leaf notebook. Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah. Summer's almost over. A new season's coming up.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. You know that weight of responsibility you can feel descending when you realize your vacation is almost over. Terry Gross may be feeling it any day now. I'm sitting in for her for one last day before I return to San Francisco. Coming up, the new adventures and intrigues of Soviet sleuth Arkady Renko. He's the hero in Martin Cruz Smith's bestseller Gorky Park. And coming up, we crack open his new sequel, Polar Star. Also, guest critic Milo Miles explores world music. For decades, other countries have listened to American tunes. Milo says it's high time we return the favor. And if you like movies with deep social content and a serious, cerebral message, if that's what you want, forget it. Guest film critic Owen Glaberman reviews the home video version of The Naked Gun. That's all coming up here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has authorized extra money for Colombia to be used in fighting drug cartels in that Latin American country. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the $65 million in aid will go for transportation equipment.
The package will include equipment for police and military personnel, with initial shipments to arrive as early as next week. In addition, it will include aircraft and helicopters to improve the mobility of Colombian forces engaged in the anti-drug effort.
Fitzwater says that violence in Colombia by drug groups is threatening the very fabric of life there. The $65 million is in addition to $2.5 million in security aid aimed at helping protect judges in Colombia. The new money comes from a special fund available to the White House for emergency situations. President Mobutu of Zaire met today with South Africa's acting president, F.W. de Klerk, for talks aimed at saving the Angolan peace process. NPR's John Madison reports the talks focused on yesterday's announcement by rebels that they were giving up a two-month-old ceasefire.
It was acting President de Klerk's first African meeting since taking office earlier this month. The two leaders spent 3 hours discussing Angola, the independence process in neighboring Namibia, and other regional issues. Afterwards, they issued a brief joint statement saying the talks were constructive and that there will be a follow-up meeting on the Angolan issue. The leaders refused to answer questions from the media. Mobutu has been mediating attempts to end the 14-year-old Angolan civil war, but following the announcement by the rebel movement UNITA that it would not abide by the ceasefire, a UNITA spokesman said today that Angolan government troops have attacked UNITA positions. I'm John Madison reporting.
Benjamin Hooks, the executive director of the NAACP, wants the FBI to investigate what he thinks may be a national conspiracy to harass blacks. For examples, he cites the recent tear gas attack on the regional office of the NAACP in Atlanta, which he says could grow out of the climate of racial intolerance that he claims took root during the Reagan administration.
I think it has to do with the repressive climate that was created by 8 years of constant preaching from the White House that somehow affirmative action is reverse discrimination, that white men are being denied their jobs, that every time you see a woman as an anchor person on the television or a reporter from the paper that she has a job that obviously a white man is better qualified for.
The NAACP is sponsoring a march in Washington tomorrow, highlighting recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court limiting the scope of affirmative action. It's to be a silent march like one 72 years ago in New York City. Final arguments were heard today in New York in the tax evasion trial of hotel executive Leona Helmsley. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Milo Miles has been following what's now called world music for 15 years, and he's going to join us on the show from time to time with reviews of the latest and most provocative rhythms from around the world. Today he has an introduction to the sounds we'll hear, beginning with this foot dancing music from Nigeria.
For decades, non-English popular music knew its place in America. Out there, off the map, not on the schedule. America was the modern world, and the music other people listened to in other languages was a mere reminder of the past to be dismissed with ease. Besides, wasn't all that stuff quaint, acoustic, primitive, exotic, and incomprehensible?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there were occasional exceptions. Watered-down versions of foreign folk music even became brief hits, but they were seen as novelties, a step away from nonsense and of no matter. It's hardly inappropriate that the Brooklyn Quartet, who took a Zulu chant to the top of the charts in 1961, called themselves the Tokens.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
A couple of landmark bestsellers that also drew on the music of Africa avoided the taint of commercial baloney. The more recent success story, Paul Simon's 1986 album Graceland, you know about. But Manu Dibango's Soul Makossa in 1973 was just as potent. Recorded in Paris with musicians from several African countries, the song became an international touchstone for disco, inspired a dozen cover versions, and even Michael Jackson quotes its chorus at the climax of Wanna Be Startin' Somethin'. Soul Makossa founded world music as we have come to know it. Canny, electric, sophisticated, irresistible. What had happened to world pop? Well, without the U.S. noticing, the global orchestra was beginning to tune up and play. The irony was that America had set the tempo. Since the end of World War II, the pop of North and South America, and particularly the black music of those countries, had been exported everywhere and interbred with local sounds. Now the international offspring were back in the USA. Of course, the big audiences here, English language chauvinists as ever, have resisted. In a market where a million-selling record is considered a necessity, world music is still just a hefty cult. But it's only a matter of time before world music becomes a common currency here and everywhere. Understanding modern media, I guess you call it. After all, American music fathered world pop. We should be proud of it. And there's another message in the music. The rise of world pop reflects a change in the international position of American culture. Music is a country's product like anything else it makes. And it's evident that as these newfangled wares from other lands, whether rye from Algeria, gamelan from Bali, or zouk from Paris, catch on and sell, America is going to have to adapt some of their style in order to stay competitive. We must not allow a music trade imbalance. Besides, there's no reason not to embrace and assimilate world pop. The beat is usually danceable, the tone frequently joyous, and the experience always amazing. Don't wait forever, America. Open the door and join the party.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for The Village Voice. We're listening to music from the group Zuke Ku'u from the Hurricane Zouk collection on the Virgin Earthworks label. This is Fresh Air. The success of Martin Cruz Smith's 1981 detective thriller, Gorky Park, and its portrayal of corrupt Moscow bureaucrats angered official Sovietdom. Not until Glasnost arrived was Smith able to visit the Soviet Union again. And now officials are even allowing a Russian edition of Gorky Park to be printed. His new novel, Polar Star, marks the return of Police Inspector Arkady Renko. Smith's hero got into trouble with the party after he solved the crimes in Gorky Park. He's been on the run since. Renko's now hiding aboard a Soviet factory ship in the Bering Sea, processing vast amounts of fish collected by American trawlers. Renko works on the slime line, gutting the catch. Here's an example of how Smith sets a scene with detail. He passed the rotary saws to the slime line, where workers stood in slots on either side of the belt. Like automatons, the first pair slit fish bellies open to the anus. The second pair sucked out livers and guts with vacuum hoses. The third pair washed slime from the skin, gills, and cavities with saltwater jets. The last pair vacuumed the fish a final time and laid the trimmed and dressed result on a belt moving toward the freezers. In the course of an 8-hour watch, the gutting and spraying spread a mist of blood and wet pulp over the belt, workers, and walkway. They were not the usual hero workers, least of all the lean, pale man with dark hair loading the dressed fish at the end of the line. When I first read that passage and wiped the fish blood off my hands, I wondered how Martin Cruz Smith researched his book.
I couldn't go to the Soviet Union. I wanted to do another book about the Soviets subject because it fascinated me too much. And yet I couldn't go back because I was then still labeled anti-Soviet scum. That was an official label and one I wore with distinction, but it meant that I couldn't get back into the country. And the only part of the Soviet Union I could reach was a piece of it that was sort of floating in the Bering Sea, which was this factory ship. So I had to go to the Aleutian Islands and go out on a boat and meet a Soviet factory ship and spend some time, as much time as I could, on the boat and with the captain and the crew. Which wasn't as much time as I'd hoped for, but it's a necessary part. At least I can't write in a complete vacuum. I have to touch down, however briefly, to know what I'm writing about.
Your hero, the investigator Renko, has found himself in exile because of his great success in Gorky Park, and he has made it all the way to this fishing ship. And it sounds like you, as official anti-Soviet scum, also found the only way you could still exist in the Soviet Union was on this fishing ship. How did you manage to slip in?
Well, it was I had an assignment from the New York Times Sunday Magazine to do an article on this joint venture between American and Soviet fishermen in the Bering Sea. And of course, in the back of my mind was maybe this would develop into something more. You never know until you get someplace. Yeah, when you get someplace, your imagination immediately starts to work or immediately lies down dead, and you don't know what's going to happen. But as soon as I got to the Aleutian Islands, I suspected there was a possibility here. I went out on the pilot ship that was going out to meet the Soviet factory ship that was in fact carrying the money for this. For the port call by the Soviet crew, so anyone on that boat was welcome. And then I got to meet the captain in a good frame of mind, and that evening took the captain and his crew to dinner at the best restaurant in Dutch Harbor, which was coincidentally the only restaurant in Dutch Harbor. And the following day, I was given a tour of the ship by the captain. But that's the way I got on board, simply going and jumping on a ship. There is no other way.
Mm-hmm. How long were you on the ship?
I was on the ship for about 2 days. When I was on the ship, then I was on and off the ship for 2 days because I spent part of the time with the captain in the harbor. It was an interesting and an intense conversation with the captain because between the 2 days came a night. And during the night, he told me that he was flipping through some old American magazines in his cabin when he came upon an old Newsweek with a picture of me identifying me as the author of this anti-Soviet tract, Gorky Park, which even the captain in Vladivostok had heard of. And so he wanted to know, apparently he'd gone around, run around the deck of the ship with this picture, asking people if it was, in fact, the face of the devil. And everyone agreed it was. And so we took a long walk on the above the harbor, on the hills around the harbor, and talked about the nature of being anti-Soviet and the distinction between that and writing an honest story. And I pointed out that Gorky Park was critical of Moscow and the Soviet Union. It was also critical of New York City. It was also critical of the FBI. And I asked his help on the work I was doing in this magazine article or whatever else I was doing. However, with the proviso, he would have no censorship or influence over it. And at the end of this conversation, he decided that he wanted to help me. And so he invited me back on board.
One of the details that you describe in sort of unrelentingly grim and fascinating detail is the slime line where the fish that's hauled in to the Russian ship is processed. You have Renko, your investigator, working on the slime line. Did you have a chance to work on the slime line, and could you describe it a bit more?
Well, I wish I had a chance to work on the slime line. I don't know. Boy, that sounds like the most insincere statement I've ever heard. I wish I'd had a chance to see people working on the slime line, I think would be more accurate. But no, I didn't, because the deal I had with the captain fell apart.
Hmm.
I was going to spend a week on his ship doing just that, watching people on the slime line, watching people in all the different aspects of how the fish were processed and brought on board. And then spend a week on an American ship. And he asked me to, in fact, stay on the Soviet ship, to leave port with him, not to leave the ship. But the Americans told me that if I left on a Soviet ship, the captain, in fact, could get in trouble. He was willing to take the risk, but I thought that that I could not abuse his generosity by putting him at risk at all. So I left on an American boat, and the deal was that when we got to the fishing grounds, I would transfer. Unfortunately, and perhaps this is what he foresaw, on the way there, the Soviet embassy in Washington found out about what was going on and barred me from the boat.
Well, since then, you have somehow been historically reconstructed, I guess, and have just recently toured Russia. How were you treated when you on your current visit?
It was so different. It was really quite like being reborn with, I don't know what the Soviet equivalent of a silver spoon is. The first time I was there, I had to go purely as a tourist, and I had no help at all from anyone. This time I went, I was given a car and a driver and an interpreter, and I was taken, ushered to an interview at the Ministry of the Interior with the general who's in charge of criminal investigation. It was the most implausible visit, return to Moscow I could have imagined.
Both Gorky Park and Polar Star give incredibly realistic senses of life in the Soviet Union, and you have accomplished this on relatively few visits each time to do your research. Now that you have been officially rehabilitated and can spend probably all the time you want, do you think you'd become overwhelmed by detail?
Well, sometimes I wonder why I don't write more about the United States. Maybe that's it. Maybe there's it's a simple fact that you're looking through almost a hole in the wall, and what you are seeing is limited. And so the imagination has to fill in everything else. In a way, that frees the imagination, I suspect. I don't analyze it too much, because I don't think it's wise to analyze the way one sees too much. I am more of a rewriter than a writer, and I guess I think about every single word I write down. But the way I see the world, the way I see the Soviet Union, I don't care to think about too much, because then if I get involved in the mechanics of it, I probably will never throw the ball. But I think there is something to what you say, Sedge, about not being overwhelmed by detail, because I suspect that that's what frees up that part of me which can simply write.
One of the qualities that your books have is of making more human the Soviet Union, and by doing it in the descriptions of the day-to-day life, the workings, the petty sort of worries and excitements that the people on the boat have. Have you had any response from people who felt you're making these people too friendly, too real, too human?
None. The people who react to the book. Let me just say the Soviets who react to the book, who have read the book, are simply are very pleased. Because first of all, they're always looking at me a little bit askance. They're always trying to figure out, does he really write them? I mean, here's this guy who's an American who has spent a total of probably 21 days in the Soviet Union. He doesn't speak Russian. Maybe he knows somebody who can write who's Russian. And that would explain better why he has this affinity for us, this sympathy for us, and likes to write about us and cares about the tiny parts of our lives.
Martin Cruz Smith, thank you very much for coming in on Fresh Air today.
You're welcome.
Martin Cruz Smith's new novel, Polar Star, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio is All Things Considered, and for a report on what's in today's news, we go to the host of today's show, Noah Adams. Welcome.
Hi, Sedge. The Voyager exploration of the planet Neptune is complete. The low-altitude flyby will have a report. Also, a report from Florida on the efforts to save the Everglades there. Joe Maglino has that story. Bob Mondello reviews the new film about John Belushi called Wired. And we'll talk with Jack Lang of the Baseball Writers Association on the question, should Pete Rose be kept out of the Hall of Fame because he's been suspended for life from baseball for betting? Pete Rose, it has been said by many, might have been the first unanimous choice for baseball's Hall of Fame.
Sounds like the theme today is natural history all the way around. Thank you very much, Noah. All Things Considered, later here on National Public Radio. Only 6 episodes of the spoofy TV show Police Squad were ever made. The show won a cult following, though, and fans can revel in their favorite gags now on home video. And the movie spun off from the shenanigans of Police Squad is also available on home video. Critic Owen Kleiberman has a review of The Naked Gun.
In comedy, it's hard to make a critical case for silliness. We can all admit to enjoying a good silly movie now and again, like Pee-wee's Big Adventure or A Fish Called Wanda. But what about a really great, really profound silly movie? Does such a creature even exist? It's perfectly respectable to refer to Marx Brothers comedies as zany works of art. But what if there were a contemporary equivalent of Marx Brothers lunacy, one that hadn't been enshrined by years of adulation from film buffs? Would today's critics even admit it? The comedies of Jim Abrahams, David Zucker, and Jerry Zucker are like Marx Brothers movies for the information age. The humor isn't based on characters, relationships, or anything else in the real world. It's silliness for its own disreputable sake. Only here, the silliness draws its inspiration from the haze of pop culture and mass media that has seeped into our imaginations. Abraham Zucker and Zucker first made their mark with Airplane. That 1980 hit became famous for its shockingly terrible puns and its whole punchy 5 laughs a minute style. In their most recent picture, The Naked Gun, the trio take their brand of hit-and-run conceptual humor to a new, exhilarating peak. This flaky masterpiece was based on their short-lived TV series, Police Squad. Like the show, it features Leslie Nielsen as bumbling, hard-boiled detective Frank Drebin. The Naked Gun is a surreal parody of TV cop shows and cop movies. But what's brilliant about the film is that it's finally about the very way in which we watch movies. About the endless stream of cliches and devices that propel us through the average 90-minute narrative without our even being aware of it.
It's the same old story. Boy finds girl, boy loses girl, girl finds boy. Boy forgets girl, boy remembers girl. and girl dies in a tragic blimp accident over the Orange Bowl on New Year's Day.
Good year?
No, the worst.
Abraham Zucker and Zucker know how to push a comic premise about five steps further than anyone else would, until the absurdity comes ricocheting off the screen. They're helped a lot here by Leslie Nielsen, who brings this role a priceless deadpan sparkle. With his blend of baritone smoothness and subliminal befuddlement, he's charming and almost soothing to watch in a way that carries an odd echo of Ronald Reagan.
Good cop. Needlessly cut down an ambush by some cowardly hoodlums.
There's no way for a man to die.
Yeah, you're right, Ed. A parachute not opening, that's the way to die. Getting caught in the gears of a combine. Having your nuts bit off by a Laplander, that's the way I want to go.
Abraham Zucker and Zucker understand that to ridicule something well, you've got to recreate what you're parodying down to the last detail. Then, you can toss in the perfect exaggerated touch, whether it's Nielsen and Patricia Presley wrapped in giant body condoms, or Queen Elizabeth appearing at a baseball game and casually joining everyone else in making the wave. The Naked Gun climaxes with an epic baseball game sequence that's every bit as intricate and as manically inspired as the opera sequence that ends a night at the opera. And it's no wonder. Abraham Zucker and Zucker are sophomoric sophisticates who give in to their headiest what-if fantasies. They know that we've all consumed more movies, more cliches, more mass media debris than we ever imagined. And they're here to blow it all to smithereens. The Naked Gun is silly, all right, but it's something more. It's a celebration of the divine American right to make fun of everything.
Oh, say, can you see?
Owen Gleiberman is a freelance writer and critic based in Boston. Danny Miller is senior producer of Fresh Air. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries with assistance from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Steve Plever. For the past 2 weeks, I've worked with these wonderful people. Terry Gross is lucky to work with them, as she will again when she returns next time, relaxed from her holiday. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time, we meet actor Raul Julia. In his new movie, he portrays the El Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero. Also, we talk to author Oscar Iuelos about his new novel, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. That and more, next time on Fresh Air.